Welcome, everyone, to What the Force. I'm Marie-Claire Gould, your host, and with me for Once Upon a Time in the Outer Rim is my co-host, Alex Kane. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And we are covering the second episode of The Book of Boba Fett today, The Tribes of Tatooine, which was, again, written by Jon Favreau, but directed this time by Steph Green. We cover this and all of these Outer Rim shows from a sort of connotative, talking about Westerns and genre and sort of where the inspirations come from, as well as a mythical and meta lens. Just make sure to like and subscribe if you want to keep up to date with all of these episodes as they come out. This will be a full spoiler deep dive. So if you haven't seen the episode, maybe turn back, go watch it. It's excellent. But we'll get into it right now. All right, Alex.
All right, so things pick up where we left off with the Order of the Nightwind, the assassin that Fennec captured last time. Boba and Fennec scare him into a confession using the threat of a Rancor monster, which is no longer in the palace. And then they head to the mayor's office, demanding to know why the assassins were hired. Thank you for turning him in, the mayor says, before ordering the prisoner's hasty execution. The mayor tells them to speak to Garza Fwip at the sanctuary bar. Fwip mentions that the twins are coming to stake their claim to Jabba's estate. These turn out to be a pair of Hutts. If you want it, Boba tells them, you'll have to kill me for it. We go back to the Bacta tank and Fett dreaming of his time among the Tuskens. They train him in the proper way to hold a gaffy stick and to fight as a Tusken Raider fights. When several of the Tuskens are massacred by a passing train of smugglers, Boba participates in the burning of the dead and takes it upon himself to find a way to put a stop to that violence. He ventures alone out into the night and finds a gang of swoop bikers, the ones from the first episode. He roughs them up and takes their bikes back to the Tusken camp. Back at their camp, Boba teaches the Tuskens how to ride the swoop bikes and to prepare for the next time the train passes through. The pikes on board the train are spice runners, and they put up a fair amount of resistance, but Boba and the natives manage to bring the train to a halt. The pikes will be spared, Fett says, only if the syndicate marches to Anchorhead and leaves the planet to deliver his terms. He says, these sands are no longer free for you to pass. These people lay ancestral claim to the Dune Sea, and if you are to pass, a toll is to be paid to them. Any death dealt from the passing freighters will be returned tenfold. After nightfall, the Tusken chief presents Fett with a gift beside the campfire, a gesture of thanks for all that he's done to help. Fett opens a tiny wicker basket to discover a lizard, and then the chief blows a brownish powder into his face. Fett slips into a nightmarish hallucination, and his memories, the sands of Tatooine, and the realm of the mystical are blended together. The Dune Sea turns to a stormy ocean, and Boba comes to a pair of similar dead-looking trees, one large, one small. He climbs the larger of the two, is enveloped by its branches, and sees a glimpse of his youth on Kamino, watching out a viewport as his father, Jango, heads off-world in their starship. Fett snaps off one of the tree's branches, and we find him carrying it as he arrives back at the Tusken camp. From this branch, he crafts a Gatterfee stick of his own, and the Tuskens dress him in black ceremonial garb. He and the tribe dance around the firelight as one.
So good. So good. Thank you for that recap.
My pleasure.
So what did you think?
I absolutely loved this episode. I a lot of hyperbolic thoughts about this.
That's okay. Fanboy. Let's do it.
Yeah, I think this was my favorite Star Wars thing since The Last Jedi, probably.
Wow. It had a lot of Last Jedi in it, didn't it? Like with the vision and the dream and the flashback feel to it. And yeah, sacred trees.
Yes. I feel myself sort of like falling in love with Star Wars again a little bit because of this episode. I dare say that's how I've felt the last couple of days. Yeah, what else? I mean, it just, Yeah, I don't know. It's a good feeling to be this kind of invested and to see like some new voices in the mix. You know, you've got Dean Cundey, the cinematographer from Halloween and The Thing, which are like two of my favorite movies of all time, coming to Star Wars for the first time.
That's amazing.
You got Robert Rodriguez hanging out and running the show. And
I mean, Jon Favreau probably doing the show that he really wanted to when he originally mm-hmm. talked about doing a Mandalorian show. He probably wanted to make Boba Fett the show.
Yeah.
And they were like, we can't make that work. Make something else work. And he's like, okay, I got this mm-hmm. story about a Mandalorian. And they're like, okay, cool. Yeah, let's do that. That ties into stuff we've already done. And then he's like, can I make my Boba show now?
Yeah.
Sorry, this is my fan fiction of office fan fiction of what goes on behind Lucasfilm. No, but it does feel like he is very into this. I have some questions about like how much is him? You know, is it only him? Like, is there a story room? I have some questions about that because it feels like it needs to be bigger and maybe more credit from a writing perspective needs to be given to others. But I don't know. I like how fleshed out the world feels. It feels mm-hmm. like Tatooine was very boring just from a visual storytelling perspective previously. So like, when have we seen Tatooine on screen? A New Hope, Return of the Jedi, The Rise of Skywalker, and Rebels / Clone Wars episodes, right? Mm-hmm. That's when we've seen it. And it's always kind of boring and empty. It feels like there's a lot going on in Tatooine Demption in a way. Like, it's interesting to be here. And it has to do with the politics. It has to do with just the interesting things that go on kind of slightly off camera of all of the things that we already knew. And I appreciate that. If they're going to put me on Tatooine, at least they've made it interesting.
Absolutely. I like the echoes of the, A New Hope and mm-hmm. Attack of the Clones and Return of the Jedi, and kind of having Boba sort of act in conversation with things we've seen Anakin do and things we've seen C-3PO do.
Yes.
And specific scenes, you know, the oral tradition where he's sort of telling the Ewoks, like, the story of the Skywalker saga.
Yeah.
in Return of the Jedi. And so to get this very like intimate fireside, oral history of the Tuskens, sort of ancient history and the lore of Tatooine feels really special.
Yep. I really love the mayor.
mm-hmm.
Like, having an Ithorian mayor who is obviously very politically savvy and realizes like Tatooine is in dispute, so he's not really going to choose a side, and he can kind of just play down the middle. And I love what he says to Boba specifically. He was actually played by Robert Rodriguez as well. He voiced the Ithorian mayor, I'm pronouncing it wrong, I'm sure. He said he's a member of the Order of the Nightwind, and then he has him killed, and then says mm-hmm. the Order of the Nightwind are not allowed to operate out of hut space. And it's sort of like a Socratic method of intimating, like, this is still hut-owned space, you idiot, mm-hmm. to Boba, right? Without actually saying anything, without betraying the other masters that are also coming for tribute, right? He's mm-hmm. kind of, he's waiting to see who wins this war. But then he gives him the information to say, well, if you go and speak with Madame Garza, you will, mm-hmm. I'm sure it will be illuminating. I love him. Like, yeah. That is a brilliant way to play a very politically savvy character who is mm-hmm. the mayor of Mos Espa, right?
Yeah. He's so cool. Like, how he plays it, just like, before you threaten me, ask yourself. Like, that is that's just so chilling. He's really good. And it's basically just Robert Rodriguez's normal voice.
Yeah. Like, and it's supposed to be like a translator, so it has no
yeah
up and down, like mm-hmm. it has no excitement to it, so it's just read kind of in a monotone way. And that in and of itself shows him to be cool. And I love his character design, how he's kind of got like fuzzy like sides to him, and like the style of how he's just like sitting there. He's like one of my favorite characters in the show now. And I've had him for 5 minutes. I need to do the one meme of Rosa holding the dog from from Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I've had the Athorian mayor for 5 minutes, and if anything happens to him, I'll kill myself and everyone else in this room. Yeah, that's me.
Yep.
Yep. I love him. He's the best.
I had a couple notes about his office. It's basically in American architecture, like everything is sort of modeled after like the same Greek style. And here in the Star Wars universe, this is basically his office is modeled after the Jedi Temple. It's like, it's totally a ziggurat with like the same sort of pattern around the lower end of it. And then it has like the towers and then the central spire as well. It's totally looks like the Jedi Temple. And in terms of like mythology and like Earth history, like ziggurats connote a point at which Earth and heaven are nearest one another, and also protection from flooding, which ties back to our whole point about Boba being very Moses-like, coming from Kamino and being born of the water.
Yeah.
But also, you know, being a member of like a chosen people and leading through, you know, the parting the sea and all that.
And that's really interesting too, because it's like, how long have these buildings existed? Did it exist when we found out that there used to be oceans on Tatooine? Yeah.
Right.
How old are these? Like, how old is Tatooine?
Yeah.
Da da da. It's so cool. I also just loved the addition of new huts. I find huts like super fascinating. Like the Mama Hut in the Clone Wars. Zero the Hut as a character is just really fascinating. And these are like new huts that like have a personality of their own and have like a very weird relationship. I had somebody who saw a picture of them and asked if they were like together, like they're married huts. And I said, no, they're twins. And they're like, that's weird. But they both had beauty marks and she had like a fan and I was obsessed with it.
Yeah. He has like some sort of little tattoo or makeup or something.
Yeah, on his chin. Like they're decorative, much like Zero was. And he used like the little chicken thing to like dab his sweat.
Oh, right. Yep. Yep.
I'm like, that's just like color. We didn't need that color, but it makes them more interesting. And the fact that like, obviously, it's a very patriarchal situation that's going on because she would only talk to him and he would talk for both of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she was constantly like behind the fan. Oh, so interesting. They added visions into my Star Wars other than like, hey, people dying. But like, this is a genuine ass vision.
I remember last time we were talking about the end of the episode or, you know, what we were hoping for in episode two. And I said something like, I hope it gets like really weird and like mystical. And you're like, whoa, whoa, tap the brakes. No. And, you know, like, let's not get our hopes up now. And like here it is. They totally delivered.
Yeah.
Like, weird, abstract, mystical, beautiful, very Last Jedi like stuff.
I've had multiple people message me and say, I've thought of you since I watched this episode, Marie Claire. I'm like, yes, I have a brand.
It's
like they gave it as a gift and a present. Like they wrapped it up and they're like, here you go, Marie Claire. This is exactly what you bought in a story. I'm like, yes. How did you know what kept me for Christmas? Yes.
Everything about that scene, that whole sequence, the vision quest was so beautifully done. And yeah. It's nice when you can look at something in Star Wars and be like, oh, here's something we haven't quite seen. Not entirely. Like this is something a little bit new. It happens rarely. And when it happens, it's so exciting, you know, kind of like the Charles Soule's Vader comic where he sort of goes into that weird dark side realm.
Yeah, it, you know, it felt a lot like that in some ways, because but like realized real life. And I don't think we've seen that outside of comic or animation yet. Like,
yeah,
I mean, given that this is only our second live action show, maybe a little bit to in The Last Jedi with Rey's cave vision.
Yeah, that's the closest thing, probably. Snapping. Yeah, the mirror.
Yeah, the mirror cave. And like her vision when she had the weird dream in TFA. Rey really had a lot of visions, actually, because she had the TFA vision where it kind of flipped and echoed and she was in different places and experiencing different things. But this had a very specific spiritual feeling to it, more like the TLJ experience. Again, visions do happen, but they are most closely related to Force users, right? We had Luke, Dagobah, right? He had a vision, but really it was just, you know, him fighting Vader, which didn't seem too weird. And when those things happen, they're very, connected to the internal subconscious of the person and the external metaconscious of the galaxy, i.e. the Force. Right. So it's like your internal subconscious is connecting with the external everything.
Yeah.
And maybe that's a little bit of what's going on. I don't know. We'll see. Maybe the lizard is a Force user.
Sort of like the soul and the oversoul, right? That's sort of another way to put it.
Yeah. I mean, the Force is like they've talked about like the big Force, right? And then there's the cosmic Force, which is kind of like the consciousness of all things. And then there's the natural Force, right? The Force that it comes from all living things and kind of feeds the cosmic Force.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, essentially you, like when you enter into one of those vergences, i.e. the tree on Dagobah, Mortis, when Yoda goes on his spiritual journey and fights a shadow version of himself, which we'll talk about later on in this episode.
Yep.
It's all like your subconscious is plugging into the subconscious or the metaconscious of the galaxy. So everything will appear from your own perspective, but it will have greater meanings to what's going on in the galaxy. I think they might be plugging into something like that. It's very much how they view visions from this, I don't know, perspective. If they're thinking about George, I've read enough interviews and I've listened to enough people talking about it who are behind the creation. They think about it in this way. Side note, I love Joanna Bennett, who is the stunt person who does the stunt work for the Tusken Warrior, the badass one with the kind of long black cloth hair, sort of. She's amazing. Her physicality is like, because she has to physically mask act, right? You have to express without any facial expressions, and she's amazing at it. Like, as good as like some mask actors like Adam Driver have had to do, where he's literally in the mask, but like she's doing an amazing job, and I absolutely ship her and Boba Fett together. That may be controversial, but I love them. When they were fighting, when they fought in the beginning, and now they're fighting to train, and she's showing him the way, and she's coming along and saving his butt. Like, come on. I love
it. Yeah, she's great. Her physicality reminds me of like Darth Maul, like back in episode one, you know?
Yeah.
Through the arms and the legs, you know, like it is like just watching her like what dive through that window and just start kicking everybody's ass. Like it's not a lot of people can do that stuff. And
you can tell like where this show, like the construction of this show and of Mandalorian is entirely based on using stunt doubles as actors, right? Like this show, Mandalorian, Pedro Pascal is very rarely actually in the suit. It's normally somebody else. The Ugnaught character, IG-11, like it's entirely based on voiceover work. It's kind of built like an animation show. I mean, it makes sense because Dave Filoni is behind this. They built it sort of like with these wireframe stunt double actors. And so we have to give way more credit to these physical actors then maybe, like, I don't know, we would have, if there's another actor who's delivering the lines, like, you think about, like, Joanna was Captain Marvel's stunt double. Like, we don't talk about Joanna. We talk about Brie Larson. But Joanna is doing all of, like, the very complex physical stunts for Captain Marvel. We need to give, like, way more credit to all of the physical actors in these shows, because they're doing so much that is only supported by voiceover. And in the sake of the Tuskens, it's sound design. Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of like George started that with Darth Maul to a degree. Because nobody talked about Peter Serafinowicz, Darth Maul actor, you know, like it really was, you know, Ray Park, you know, doing those things in the beginning. And so,
yeah. And just because we can't see her face doesn't mean that she's not just blowing it out of the, or hitting it out of the park with,
yeah,
with her acting. Like, she's sexy. I don't know how, but it happened, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Any other thoughts before my last kind of thought, before we get into genre and inspirations?
No, just that, you know, like to your point about how these shows have used stunt people, it really is kind of George's dream for, like, that Underworld series coming to fruition, where, like, how do we do all this pioneering special effects technology that, like, ILM was built on, but make it affordable so that, like, almost anybody can kind of use it, and, like, you're not spending whatever $60 million on, like, an episode of TV, like, or however much it is. But, you know, basically, you know, he couldn't make that TV show back in, like, 05 or whatever because of financial reasons. And now, you know, it's a nice, like, cost saving measure, I guess, stunt people.
It absolutely is, because they don't need to give the same credit.
Yeah.
And that comes with pay. So I'm like a little on the fence about it, right? I feel like Joanna, because she is in, especially this episode, like, second billing.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm a little on the fence about this. I like that they save money, but also that comes at the expense of she is genuinely acting her butt off. Okay. So before we get into genre and inspiration, I want to say that Star Wars in general steals liberally from many cultures across the world. That has been a thing that has always happened. I'm not saying it's right. I just say that we're kind of at a point where, especially this episode and, like, the Tuskens, they were heavily influenced by the Bedouin culture, as well as indigenous and native tribes across the world, right? Like, that feeling of indigenousness. And it feels like they are very much humanizing the Tuskens. I would say that that's, we're definitely feeling that, right? We feel empathy with the Tuskens, whereas, like, in previous, you know, episodes of Star Wars, the, you know, big ones, the movies, we were treated to only one particular lens of them being animals, you know, or whatever, right? And they've humanized them, and they've made them people for us, which is great. It is great. And I'm very thankful that the movies and stories are going along with that. I just feel like if you're going to use these stories as an allegory for a real life culture or experience, which they absolutely are, they need to actually credit a diverse writing room. So if they have a diverse writing room, they need to tell us, right? Okay, so Jon Favreau was the lead writer or whatever. And if they actually have a diverse writing room, they need to tell us that. They need to credit those people, as well as they should have other people who are lead writers on episodes from a diverse perspective, especially if it deals with something that's incredibly sensitive. So that's my, like, thoughts on that. I really, really recommend that you seek out, especially Jordan Mason's article on indigenous inspiration and, you know, native influences on Star Wars. It's going to be in the liner notes. I'm going to put it in there. So just look for that there. But seek out other people who are from an indigenous background to talk about some of the things that are happening in the show. I will call them out so you can look for those things, but I really want you to hear that from their perspective. I think that's fair.
Yes. Yeah. Jordan's article is very good, and it's very balanced and like it's sort of comprehensive across, you know, a lot of Star Wars history. It's not just about, you know, the mm-hmm. Tuskens. It's not just about these Disney Plus shows. It's kind of a big picture and eye opening in that way.
And he wrote it before The Rise of Skywalker came out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a good place to start. And then there are other people talking about it. So if it's interesting to you, of course, I think it's important for you to understand, like, it's a more complicated thing than just one way or another. I just think that if Favreau has a vision, it has to include the voices that he is drawing an allegory against.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's talk about some of those influences, which of course include the Bedouin and of course indigenous people. Lawrence of Arabia, which I didn't see it in the first episode, but it is absolutely apparent in this episode, especially with the train shot. I actually think that the rescuing of the boy calls back to Lawrence of Arabia in the first episode as well. George also used to say that Lawrence of Arabia also inspired him for like the feelings of the dunes and going across the dune sea and stuff like that. There's a lot of that in this. The train shots, there's some that are almost shot for shot, like what happens in Lawrence of Arabia during the Turkish train takedown.
Yeah, there's also that shot that is Ralph McQuarrie's original, like, Tuscan production painting, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
Like, compositionally pretty identical. And our Joanna Bennett is, I think, sort of front and center compositionally where the original Tuscan design was. So it's kind of fun. But yeah, it's just like a piece of debris and a couple of the Tuscans in the camp.
Yeah.
Pretty one-to-one sort of Easter egg moment.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think whenever they can pull in McQuarrie, they do. As far as other sort of deserty influences, there's still a lot of Dune. It feels like just having an outsider who's bringing technology and different ways of thinking into the story. I would say it's more currently like a techno savior type situation going on where he's like showing them like, hey, you have guns. Now you also have speeders and we'll give you the machines that you need. And like, I have no problem with that. I have some generalistic concerns that I'll save until the end based on sort of storytelling and like what I know of Jon Favreau. As long as he's not saying that they have to live their life in a modern way because it's better, I think then it's okay that he's showing them things. You know, I think, we'll get into some of the story things we're we're concerned about later.
Mm-hmm. The thing, when you said techno savior behind the scenes, I thought of the ways in which, you know, machines are kind of symbolic of empires and war and,
mm-hmm.
You know, the train as a symbol for sort of inevitable progress and sort of industrialization, sort of the destruction of the earth for the sake of, you know, bigger, better.
Yeah.
Capitalism.
Yeah. No, it's always, you know, it's always capitalism. Right.
And yeah,
mm-hmm. Like this ties into questions of colonialism, like literally nobody else is indigenous to Tatooine but the Tuscan. They remember a time before there was sand, it was oceans, right? And you know, certainly look up Land Back if you're interested, because Boba basically says, like, you know, the Tuscans deserve their land back and also reparations. And like, that's where it also makes me feel a lot like Dances with Wolves, like he gets adopted into the tribe and, you know, there's a lot of things that happen, but then, I think generally there's a lot of things going on in this and they're pulling from a lot of sources. So it could mean a lot of things. I do want to say, like, the biggest influence that for me that feels like the most natural and amazing is the creation of the Tusken sign language that they've created for Mandalorian. Troy Kotsur, he was the creator of it, and he was actually a character playing a Tusken, and he created the sign language for the Tuskens to use. And he's actually a deaf actor playing the role. So I just think that's really, really cool. And like, to me, like, he deserves a writing credit.
Yeah.
He's created something for Star Wars that is going to be used probably forever now.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, instead of just hiring like a quote unquote, like, language expert, you know, you've got sort of authentic representation. And yeah, like you said, it's something done on sort of a work for hire basis that's just going to get sort of absorbed into the larger Star Wars for forever. And yeah, that's where that problem comes in that we were sort of talking about before we recorded, which is just like, you know, it says written by Jon Favreau, and that's the way Hollywood and TV does things.
Yeah.
But is it, you know, a legit representation, you know, crediting anybody who's like read about the way like screenplays are credited or anything like that? It's very messy and not representative of the work and the collaborative efforts that go into things. And that's sort of always been true of Star Wars.
Talking a little bit too much about how the sausage gets made, but these things are important and representation is important. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the fact that we have this thing that exists, this Tusken sign language, and it's going to be used probably all throughout this show. And whenever we see Tuskens in the future, we go back to Knights of the Old Republic time, we'll get Tuskens who are probably going to use sign language. Troy totally deserves to, like, not only have this mentioned in an article, which I searched to find out, but somewhere where it means something.
Yeah.
But that's just not, like, how Hollywood works. So I feel bad about that.
Yeah. I'm reminded of the Star Wars novelization from 1976. You know, the cover of the book says by George Lucas, and Alan Dean Foster famously wrote the whole thing basically. So, you know, it's a little messy how these things happen, but yeah, it's Hollywood. Hopefully Hollywood's changing, but yeah.
Yeah. I would say it would make me feel a little bit better if different names appeared. As you can tell that more when there's a writer's room, because different people in the writer's room will write episodes, right? Maybe you'll get the first one done by Jon Favreau, but then there's, like, you see it on The Bad Batch, right? There's a writer's room for Bad Batch, and it's literally, like, every couple of episodes is done by a different person. Maybe an entire arc is done by one person, but, you know, it helps make the universe better if you have more voices who are contributing to the conversation, especially if you're speaking to specific cultural experience.
Yes. Yeah. And if you like sort of follow TV writers on like Twitter and stuff, they'll say like a staff writer typically is responsible for like one or two scripts per season. And so when you see written by Jon Favreau, you know, there's alarms going off. Like I find it hard to believe that he's sitting at his computer by himself and coming up with all this stuff and saying, here it is, Kathy, let's roll, you know, or whatever. I mean, but
this has been his dream for well over 12 years.
Okay, fair.
You know, so maybe this was the first thing that he pitched and he had actually written the whole thing and it just took refining, and maybe it was refined in a writer's room or through an editorial group or whatever. And that's fine. I just get the feeling like there could be more done to include more voices.
Yeah. I think part of my excitement over this episode was just seeing the directed by Steph Green and having it be, you know, a new directorial voice. I think that was a huge help in just kind of me embracing this episode the way I did day one. I was just kind of like, wow, like that blew me away.
And she is an experienced episodic director. Have you seen that resume?
Yeah. Watchmen I did see, and that's a phenomenal series on HBO. Yeah.
Like, she's done like The Americans, Watchmen, like her, but it's like she'll do like two or three episodes of a show, yeah. and they're all just really wonderful shows and amazing. So mm-hmm. it's like she's not going to maybe be a showrunner, but she's going to take what the vision of the showrunners are and execute it with like exceptional perfection. So yay mm-hmm. her.
Yeah.
I wonder how she know, like, does she know Favreau? Does she know Rodriguez? Like,
well, I think originally one of the showrunners that was supposed to be on like Andor was like a guy from The Americans. So mm-hmm. that was sort of where my brain drew the line, but that's just kind of my, you know, Kennedy is not somebody who just kind of is asleep at the wheel. Like, you know, no, she hired Ryan.
She's always looking for good talent.
She
hired
Ryan Johnson. Yeah. She got Ryan Johnson. She got Deborah Chow. Like, so I guess I wasn't too surprised, but, yeah, a lot of talent behind this episode.
So again, we start out with this dual story, right? Mm-hmm. but we start back in the, and in the real world. I actually recommended to my friend that he watch both episodes back to back since he hadn't caught up, because I said it actually feels like they did this episode as a two-parter but then released it in two parts.
I see what you mean. Yeah, it's pretty immediate.
Because the punch that we were kind of expecting, or like the kick to say, why is this show important, happens at the end of episode two, right? With the True. Train, mm-hmm. with him accepting this mantle, right? Everything. Yeah. So it's interesting. We're back in the modern, quote unquote, Boba time. We're back in Boba time. And, you know, he is trying to be this daimyo. What do you think is going on with the city politics?
It's pretty weird. It's there's this very upfront, in your face, emphasis on like decorum and like, this is the traditional way of Tatooine. And like, you know, you can't go back there. It's restricted. You know, I did not see your litter arrive. And then yeah. like sort of awkward pause, you know, that we've heard that like three or four times now, because Boba is like, I don't have time for your institutional bullshit. I'm a romantic poet in tune with nature now, man, you know, and I don't know, it's just like the tension between Boba and the majordomo.
And the society, right? Also.
Yeah.
Right. Like, mm-hmm. like the society is saying, no, you need to literally be squishing people under your foot too, as you go places. Like that's,
yes,
that's what we see. We actually see a litter, right? Mm-hmm. You need to be crunching people under your foot or we won't take you seriously.
Yeah.
Which is
the huts arrive and they're above, like literally above everyone. And you've got like a drum beat to like sort of let everybody know they're out there.
Yeah.
You know.
You'd think the smell would let everybody know, but no.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, and I loved, again, I brought it up with the mayor, but the mayor, like, playing both sides, knowing that, like, this is a confrontation that he's not going to choose sides on, mm-hmm. And then having the huts show up and it all making sense and it all clicking into place. I think what we're going to get in the end, and this is a little bit of speculation, which I was going to save to the end, but I'm going to add it in here now because I think it's important, is that the lessons that he learns with his Tusken tribe will be brought into use with pulling together the different interested parties on Tatooine for reasons.
Yeah. I think a lot of the unspoken things that are going on here are just a general fear of the huts because of their, like, the huts are sort of like an imperial culture, you know, they're colonialists, you know, yeah. from hailing from another planet, you know, they used to be sort of like the driving force behind organized crime throughout the galaxy and, you know, hyperspace travel, like as soon as that was invented, you know, they were using it for to make money. And yeah, so I think there's an element of, you know, oh, thank God the Empire's gone, but like, oh no, like, you know, the huts are still like this ever present thing. Like Garsif Whip, is she kind of seems terrified to come right out and say things. And, you know, the mayor sort of speaking in riddles, you know?
Yeah. Like, I don't want to fully admit to like helping you, so I'll just point you in the right direction.
Yeah.
We see that most poignantly when Fennec points out to Boba that if they want to kill the twins, they have to get permission, which means you're never truly in charge, right? Mm. And they know they're safe because like it's too costly to kill a Hutt because then all the Hutts will come after you.
Yeah.
Right? You can't kill them because you'll piss off the entire family and then they'll like all come and kill you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
And they have very powerful people at their beck and call, like the Wookiee that shows up, which is actually a Wookiee from the comics.
Aphra, yeah.
Yeah, from Aphra. It's, how do you pronounce that name? It's black.
In my head, it's like Black Chrysanthemum, but I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. And he's pretty well known from the Aphra comics, which I've read. Yeah. Then he is tired and so has another nap with his psychologist pod.
Yeah.
And there's a kind of it's weird. There's a whooshing sound when he starts to kind of enter into dream flashback land. It's like a sound, which is quite literally the sound of a baby's heartbeat. You're like in utero.
Yeah.
Right? So you're listening to the baby's heartbeat. They're using that little monitor to like just listen to the baby's heartbeat. It's like
yep.
That's the sound of it. We heard Boba Fett's baby heartbeat as he enters into dreamland. He's a fetus. He's being reborn. Yeah. Isn't this nice? and basically it's him like working through stuff he's been through in the past, which is so cool and interesting. He becomes closer part of the tribe. He, you know, helps them with technology. I'm going to help you. This is ridiculous. I can't believe that half your people just died when we were just hanging out, having some sand melon, some black melon juice. Right. And that leads us into the, him teaching people how to drive.
Yeah.
The speeders. I did love how the Tusken chief called the train the long speeder. I thought that was really cool. But he, you know, there's so many memes and people like showing like how he's like showing them how to drive. And then they talk about like how to jump between things. And he gives them all the skills that they need to take down the train and sort of take back what is theirs, which is the land, right? They can survive off the land. They're fine. What they can't survive is constantly being shot at. And so it's like reversing the power dynamic of the situation with the Pikes. Let's talk about the Pikes.
Yeah, they're interesting. Like they're sort of what a late George Lucas addition to the galaxy, right? Sort of like, one of those like Saw Gerrera type things that it's like, you know, or lots of stuff that they brought in the Disney era where, you know, it's like, this is one of the last things that George created. So we're going to use it a bunch.
Yeah.
And the Pikes kind of always come to mind.
They were Clone Wars. Sort of the Pike Syndicate was, and they're known for refining spice and dealing with things almost like the Breaking Bad, but like industrialized crime lords. Mm-hmm. Like they're all about refining stuff and like doing it with science and then selling it for lots of money.
Kind of like a diamond cartel is kind of what comes to mind.
Almost.
But yeah, I mean, Breaking Bad too.
Well, just because they're all about like the refining of the spice. That's their thing. They're like the chemists, you know. Mm-hmm. They've always kind of seemed like that. I didn't ever remember seeing a Pike with its mask off.
This was, I think, the first time I've seen them. I'm pretty sure. Maybe it's happened in comics. But yeah, this was to see a few of them without the mask, or at least the main one. Yeah, it was definitely, it felt like the first time.
It was weird. I felt uncomfortable. I like their masks.
Well, yeah, they seem to have such a different shaped head with the mask on.
It's more intimidating. They wear the masks for reasons. But this is definitely going to lead into some sort of consequence, right? Because two things. So first, the Pikes don't necessarily want to listen, right? They're changing the power dynamic of the Dune Sea. And let's face it, this tribe is only one tribe. And back to our Lawrence of Arabia parallel, that's actually something that's brought up in Lawrence of Arabia when, you know, the one Arab group that Lawrence is working with says, yeah, we're just one group. And so Lawrence like literally needs to go and like prove himself to all of the other tribes so that they're all working together for the benefit of Arabia. And basically to take things back from the Turks. I think that's going to happen.
Yeah.
I mean,
it seems like the end game. Yeah.
He's going to, this episode was called The Tribes of Tatooine. And we saw really one tribe, except for if you count the Pikes as a separate group or the swoop bike gang as a separate group.
Yeah.
I think he's going to have to prove himself to all of these other tribes and bring them together. Because they're not all on the same page. They cover that in the show, right? Like the chief is talking about how not everybody is the same. We're not all friendly. Like you wouldn't have been accepted in other tribes. And that feels like a challenge to me for Boba Fett.
Yeah.
And this leads him into his initiation kind of fully into the tribe or becoming kind of an adult in the tribe, I would say, in a way. New clothes, goes on a spirit journey. He gets new clothes after that. And he gets to forge a weapon. It's all cool. Yeah. Any thoughts on this before we dig into the mythological stuff that happened?
Yeah, I guess it feels sort of like, yeah, second sort of adolescence for him. Like you referred to like the newborn heartbeat and like the ultrasound effect or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, like with The Last Jedi, we sort of had the sort of second Luke Skywalker phase or whatever, you know, sort of exile Luke. And now we're getting sort of Boba reaching like a new level of maturity. Like he's not just some mercenary, right? So he's going through these adolescent rituals in order to become, you know, not just the clone of Django, not just the guy who does everything, you know, the same for money and whatnot.
Yeah. Like, is he forging a new path? Is he, you know, bound to follow in the footsteps of his, what, like 6 million brothers?
Yeah. Right. If we're talking about like the Matrix, we would call this like a spiritual awakening, right? Like,
yeah,
this is a big deal for him.
And Favreau is a fan of Campbell, at least. He's talked about how he's read A Hero with a Thousand Faces, and he pulled on that heavily for Mandalorian. I bet you at the end of this season, we'll be able to map out a hero's journey. I can already start.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So we'll see how far this goes. I think it'll be super interesting to actually see it all in the end and all together. But let's get into the mythological meat because that's my favorite part. All right.
Yeah.
Trains and roads. All right. The train itself is psychologically, when we have trains or roads and they're not ours, it means that we need to follow our own path. If we try to follow that path, we will inevitably end up following somebody else's path. And so to cross those trains or to cross those roads. Also, it weighs psychologically on a people. And I'm specifically thinking about, there was a thing that came out from the US government last year where they talked about the inherent racism of our infrastructure in the United States, how like roads and buses and trains and like things were built in a racist manner. And in so many ways, because these things are based in capitalism and they don't care about anything that is the base of the world. They don't care about the people. They don't care about you know, what they're doing to the people. They don't care about the actual land itself. This is where we run into a lot of conflict because the need to only think about selflessness versus selfishness, totally ties in with the sort of train/road concept.
Yeah.
It's really interesting.
Yeah. I'm reminded of like so many Westerns where, you know, whether it's Once Upon a Time in the West or, you know, The Magnificent Seven or even the video game Red Dead Redemption, like the train comes in or, you know, sort of like a big machine gun or anything like that, any sort of machinery like a train is automatically like this disruptive thing. You have this like small community of people making things and sort of subsisting off the land. They've got their humble little church. And then here comes the train with the sort of like the northerners or the, you know.
Yeah. Like the people from the city, the big city.
Yeah. The guy, all the people with the books and the big ideas about, you know, money and quote unquote progress and things like that.
Yeah. Or the train goes through the lands. Or yeah. Mm-hmm. The road goes through the land or the people, right? And cuts a people from themselves, right? So yes. Maybe the community was one community at one point. But mm-hmm. since the train has come through, there's a north side of the tracks and there's a south side of the tracks, right? And so this train is still going to come and not everybody is going to agree with it. But yet this tribe is now in charge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing because it doesn't mean that the other Tuscans won't still attack the train or see what was done and try to attack the train or whatever, right? So it'll be interesting to see how this develops as a metaphor inside of the show.
Yeah, I'm sort of reminded of like the painter like J.M.W. Turner. I think you would draw these like beautiful, like very abstract monochrome landscapes, and then a train would like be going through it, and it's like this really like violent phallic thing like off to the side and then sort of it becomes like the focal point for the composition, but it's like, you know, there's something alien about it and violent. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I don't know.
No, that's awesome.
and these pikes are, they're off-worlders, they're colonizers, you know, they're not really supposed to be there, quote unquote, much like a train through the desert or whatever. Yeah.
And so like their whole deal is they're not supposed to be there, but is the train passing the desert to like bring people from one side of the desert to the other? I have questions because there's spice obviously on the train, but the reason for transporting it is not primarily spice. I've always, like, the thing about Star Wars that's really weird is, like, obviously they have ships that can fly, so why would they ever have a ground land transport, like a speeder? I don't know. Is it hard to traverse Tatooine in a flying ship? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Don't look too close.
Yeah, it is Star Wars, so there's some hand waving and metaphor going on, but yeah, it's like, I guess you could say
direct parallel to Lawrence of Arabia was more important.
right. Yeah. It was an important movie for like Spielberg and Lucas and De Palma and those guys. But also like maybe to avoid detection would be the kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. That I would, like because they're doing illegal activities. And so,
you know, I'm like was writing like the novelization, you might say like something like in the sky would be easily detected by scanners and nonsense like that.
But stop doing all the heavy lifting for Star Wars, Alex.
Yeah. You know, I don't know.
The next kind of point that really, I loved was the concept of going on a hunt as a tribe.
Yeah.
Right. And, and how that tied into the other sort of symbolic initiations that, Boba Fett, and also how the other members of the tribe, he kind of gave that to them. Like he taught them how to drive. He taught them the ways of mechanical things. And so like there's something really enticing about sharing cultures in some ways. It's like, it's very interesting. So he's like, he shows them the ways of the machinery and they show him like the spirit of the hunt and like the sacred traditions and giving him the garb of adulthood within the Tuscans. Like, it's very interesting. All of the things that are presented in this show are an adolescent becoming an adult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Boba is not always a character, you know, in the comics or when he's younger that we immediately think of as like being somebody who's super adult and functional out in the real world, so to speak. Like, so one thing that really stuck out in this episode is when he opens the little wicker gift and the lizard is in there.
Yeah.
His response and his like graciousness about a lizard. I love his performance there. I love everything about
I will his let it reaction. Guide me. Yeah.
Yeah. He's just like, he's surprised. He's grateful. He's not in any judgy. Way. Yeah.
Right. Like he didn't judge it.
He rolls with it. Yeah. It's very much like how if you got a gift that you were a little bit confused by, but you were appreciative, like it is how you would react. And I don't know. I thought that was a really good acting moment for Morrison.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. All right. Let's get into this spirit journey. I did want to briefly talk about water just before that to say, because he gets flicked in the face with like the black melon juice, which is water for us, right? Water. He gets flicked in the face, but water is present in every single time he's dreaming, he's having these visions. He's like, water is so fundamentally important to Boba Fett. And like from a psychological perspective, water represents the subconscious and transformation and change and immutability. It's all about him transforming the in utero heartbeat. Like, it's all about him being reborn and going on that. And it's fascinating because there's so many continuous symbols that are pointing in the same direction. And so it's kind of like you have several road signs saying your turn is on the left in 300 miles, your turn is on the left in 200 miles, your turn is on the left in 100. You know, like that was way too much space. 300 miles is a really I'm from Canada, we're in meters, I don't know miles. Apologies. but what I'm saying is that it's consistently showing these things, and that to us, and subconsciously, especially if there isn't symbolic confusion, is really satisfying. Our brains like symbols that are repetitive and tell us the same things.
Yeah. It's like reassurance that we're getting it in a way.
Yeah.
One thing about water that occurred to me is like this idea too, that for us, you know, like a flood is just something that happens when it rains a lot, but like flood or the ocean from like a biblical mythic standpoint is really like the apocalypse, you know. It's it's a total rebirth of the world, basically.
Yeah. It's like resetting the landscape and resetting society and resetting things.
Yeah. Yeah, which interacts interestingly with that the oral history of the Tuscans and Tatooine, of course.
Yeah, and that I love because then it's tying directly to he is a man of water. He's from an ocean planet. There was oceans on Tatooine. There's a similarity in that. And also oceans are the giver of all life. Mm-hmm. It is healing. It is super feminine. As a, like, what is missing in this Star Wars universe is all of the femininity, right? We're missing all of the oceans. We're missing all of the life-giving of our symbols. But it's all there, and they're making direct reference to it symbolically. Mm-hmm. What is going on in my Star Wars, Alex?
I don't know. It's interesting that you've also got the Paul Atreides element too. Like, you've got like Venus and birth imagery and all that stuff with water too. But then we've been talking about Lawrence of Arabia, but then you've got, Paul Atreides is from essentially an ocean planet, I think.
Yeah. That's the parallel that I'm thinking of. Like, he's from an ocean planet and he goes to Dune and he dreams about water all his life. And Oh, so good. You ready for the spirit journey / vision quest?
Yes, very.
It's more
ready.
Of a, like, to me, it was a vision quest, but I have to say, like, there are many cultures across the world that take psychedelics to have an experience like this. And it's like helpful. So cool. That lizard, when he went up his nose, made me think of the licking frog thing from The Simpsons.
Oh, I'll have to find that on YouTube or Disney Plus or something.
It's fine. okay, so let's talk about lizards before we actually get into the journey. Lizards are like snakes. They're a psychopomp, which is a thing that, because they live under the ground as well as above ground, they can traverse between worlds. Interesting when we're talking about something that is meant to go into his brain, speak directly to his brain, and guide him on a vision quest. Lizards specifically also are all about regeneration or rebirth, because they can regrow limbs and tails and all of that. And they are very much, especially in indigenous and native traditions, used as a symbol to guide a person in new life or new opportunities. So this is all on brand with that.
Makes me think of, is it Skier from the High Republic comics, I think? I think he lost an arm and it's growing back.
And he walks the desert and we get flashes of him in his classic Return of the Jedi armor, right? He's got the little what, sash. He's got his cape.
Classic
armor.
Boba.
Classic Boba. We get those flashes. So this is psychologically telling us that this ego death is happening. Who he formerly was, is he's dying. The former self was dying, right? So who he was, the Boba, the terrible Boba from the comic book that came out recently that just killed people for no reason, is dying. I think we're all okay with this. Maybe not all of us, but I am. And he goes towards this tree, and the dunes, the sand is shifting and looks like an ocean with like lightning above, and it's almost on the edge of rain.
Yeah, right. It's very blue, Django blue, you might say, Camino blue. And then the lightning is very sort of Exegol. It's sort of like nightmare, you know, territory.
It's powerful. Yeah. There's something significant happening. And he approaches these two trees, one that is large and spread out, significant, and a tiny little tree that is next to it with only kind of two branches. That's interesting. What do you think of the trees?
Well, it just occurred to me that they're very much like the scene from Mad Max Fury Road, where there's sort of like the random tree out in the desert, and it's like, it's sort of underworld, very post-apocalyptic.
Yeah, they're dead. The trees are dead.
They're dead. They look dead,
They're a remnant of the former life that was here.
Yeah.
But they're also, in my opinion, symbolic of the life that it is now. Mm-hmm. Like, we have a larger tree and a smaller tree. To me, that could be Django and Boba.
Yeah.
Right? The two branches on the smaller tree could be Boba and Omega. Omega's probably still alive. That would be really cool.
Would hope so, yeah.
It doesn't seem like they're shying away from pulling in things from comics in this episode, so maybe they're also making a spiritual reference to other things. But he approaches the large tree and touches the wood, and the tree is filled with creatures with red eyes.
It's very like Disney jungle type of imagery, like this sort of like these red eyes of like what things lurk out in the jungle, so to speak. And
red in Star Wars has only one meaning. I hate to say that. But
the Sith, you mean?
Yeah, it's evil, it's darkness, it's the dark side.
The dark side, yeah.
The dark side. Because, you know, specifically like Dark Yoda in the Yoda's adventures that happened in the Clone Wars, where he's off on his own and he fights the shadow version of himself, which is an exceptional episode to talk about shadows and shadow selves. The tree is filled with shadowed, red-eyed creatures that he can't he can't fully see. And so, like, to me, that is the destruction of this tree, right? This is the remnants. Usually if there's like if there's like birds in a tree, it's symbolic of like new life and like reincarnation, resurrection, things like that. This is like the husk of a tree with only the scavengers remaining, right? You and I both agree what the tree is, which is the tree is, with all of its branches, is all of the clones. And like, what's really interesting is that trees traditionally also reflect the cosmos and like life, right? So because they dig into the underworld, they are exist within Earth, and then they also touch up to the sky. It is showing us that at this point in time, the galaxy is sick. And we remember, like, this is, I don't know, a couple of days after Luke, a couple of days after Luke threw him into the Sarlacc. How long was he in the Sarlacc? Probably not that long. Oh, or he got chucked into the Sarlacc.
I can't imagine it'd be more than like a couple days or something at most, right? I mean,
yeah,
I don't
like,
know.
Have they blown up the Death Star? Is the Emperor dead? I don't know. Who knows?
Good
but
question.
It's tying into something larger, right? Representative. And even if it's just his subconscious, there's all of this legacy of everyone that has ever looked like you, because there's been like 6 million of you, has died.
Yeah. Or are without purpose at minimum, right? This sense of, you know, unless they're part of the alliance, like, I guess, you know, Rex would be at that time. Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of them dead.
A lot of them are dead. And the tree also represents lineage, right? So that's where we feel like this is tree, like family tree. This is literally his family tree. This is everything that has come from Jango Fett. And he is the little tiny tree off to the side that he is not focused on.
Yeah.
He's small compared to the legacy of his father.
In this vision, he's watching his father fly away from him.
Yeah.
And he's stuck in the window, like the small boy, you know, with, he's probably the only human on Kamino at that moment. And, you know, watching his father leave to do God knows what for God knows who. And he's, you know, I don't know. He looks like scared, and he's separate from, you know, so.
And we have this flash back and forth between this like vision of his water planet and the rain against the glass, which is an old storytelling cinematography trick where the lead actor can't cry, so they reflect his face through glass with rain, or there's rain on the glass, so you know that he's feeling sad and he's crying on the inside. That's that's an old trick. Same with a bus going by and swallowing the person and them disappearing. That's also an old cinematography trick. But so it's flashing back and forth between him being in his old armor and dying in the Sarlacc pit, and then he's dying in his white outfit, and his dad is leaving him. What is going on there for you?
Gosh, I mean, I guess, like, I noticed that his outfit when he's out of the armor is kind of similar to Lawrence of Arabia. The image that really stuck with me are the branches sort of wrapping around him as the sort of the red eyes are behind him. And so he's sort of stuck within what the sort of legacy of the past.
Yep.
Which I don't know, again, like the very sort of simple associations that I made thinking about the vision are the whole scene is blue. So I think, Jango's armor was originally blue. Boba painted it green. You know, I'm thinking about, you know, this idea of like the Mars trilogy. There's like red Mars, blue Mars, green Mars, that sort of progression of dead planet, ocean transformation, eventually leading to life. You know, you get that in like Dune. You know, Ray talks about that sort of, you know, I didn't know this, there was this much green in the whole galaxy.
Yeah.
Because she's used to deserts everywhere. You know, I think they're playing with like very simplistic things here, which are, you know, universal.
They're not super complicated to figure out. They feel right when you talk about them.
Yeah. Yeah. He's looking for his midlife crisis. That's going to get him jazzed about existing again. You know, he just crawled out of hell and is still here. So what do I do now? Right.
Yeah. Like, what does all this mean? And he's looking for purpose, which is also cool.
In Robert Rodriguez's first episode, you know, The Mandalorian, like chapter 15 or whatever, he says like fate sometimes steps in to rescue the wretched or something like that. So he doesn't feel that he deserves this resurrection. Like, what have I done to, you know, earn this second lease on life, this redemption or whatever? Yeah. And so he's sort of like wrestling.
Oh, Alex, why. What does he need to be redeemed for?
I don't know. But, you know, it's just this idea of like, you know, you wake up in the morning and you're like, ah, shit, this again. And, you know, you stare into the abyss and you say, you know, what am I going to do today to, you know, to be better, to grow, yep. to.
And sometimes it takes a near-death experience for you to be wanting to change and wanting to experience your existence in a different way.
Yeah.
Oh, so good.
And like I literally, the first thing I thought of when I saw this scene was that Dark Yoda episode and just the abstractness of it and just kind of the, and, you know, in that episode, Yoda is looking for immortality, you might say, or how to sort of reach the spirit realm, the afterlife, like how do we get in touch with the cosmic force or what have you? And
how do I become a force ghost for dummies? That's exactly what he's trying to do. And, if, you know, Qui-Gon Jinn is giving him no help. So he's like, fine, I'll go on your quest. And that's a very abstract experience. Like, I think people forget, like, George created those episodes. George created Mortis. Like, George created the Dagobah tree. Like, this is all on brand for George.
Mm-hmm.
And it's cool. It's cool. It's neat, you know, to be like,
yeah.
Well, you know what? I'm gonna have a lizard up my nose now.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean,
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, well, just, you know, they hung out with George on set of Mandalorian. You know, they might have workshopped ideas. You never know. But yeah, it definitely fits into that idea of like spiritually asking yourself, like, what next? You know, where do I go from here?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So what is the lizard's name?
Did it have like a name?
No, I'm just name it for me. What's the lizard's name?
Colin.
Colin
Trevorrow. No, I don't know. Sorry, my brain is you know.
Okay, I was gonna call him Booger, but okay.
There you go. That's better.
You're gonna kill me, Alex.
Sorry, I don't know. We have fun.
His name is not Chris Terrio. All right.
No.
All right. So, I mean, that's anything else symbolic that was like really resonant for you? I felt like there was so much to dig into. It all feels very much, you know, sympathetic with what we're already seeing from an external journey perspective for Boba. So, when they show a symbolism, if it reflects what's happening for the character, it feels more satisfying. And that's why this episode feels so satisfying.
Yes. After the dark Yoda thought, I also was reminded of the Geonosians and the planet Geonosis being fairly red in color like Mars. Yeah. So again, the red eyes, that kind of felt like the Geonosians, and just how they're sort of, you know, they've got that kind of, you know, they could be flying in a tree or whatever, and they might haunt, you know, a little boy who, you know, saw his father murdered on that planet, you know, things like that.
Yep. I'm just hoping we get more like crazy weird stuff that happens in the rest of this season. I'm super excited and stoked to see it. It's fun to dig into. All right. So we're going to just talk a little bit about some of our fears. It feels good to air them a little bit. Yeah. We're done pretty much discussing the episode with everything that we loved. If you're like, hey, that's good for me, I don't need to listen to the rest of this, you feel free to turn off this episode if you don't want to listen to us kind of be like, and now we're afraid. But it's been lovely to have you. If you are turning the episode off now, I think my fears are valid because I'm a very sane person. So we'll talk about that. Okay, let's start. I'm worried for the Tuskens. My fear is entirely from a story perspective. Inevitably, what we have given Boba, and again, these are things entirely from Boba's perspective, which is we have given Boba something he cares about, something he is accepted into. And so in Favreau's mind, at least how he has talked about acceptance and, I don't know, you know, like mentors especially, people that give the main character knowledge, like Quill and IG-11. When he was speaking in the Mandalorian documentary that went behind the scenes, the gallery episode, he was like, and they had to die. And all of the other directors and writers around the table were like, but why, John? And he's like, it just needed to happen. It's important for a character to develop. I'm like, okay, John. These are shorthands. They are shorthands to give the character impetus to go on to the next phase. But sacrificing the Tuskens that he has been accepted into and found a home with will piss me off. Yeah. Sacrificing them for the sake of the story, right? And specifically, mm-hmm. we're talking about three characters within the Tuskens. We're talking about the little kid. We're talking about hot Tusken girlfriend. And we're talking about Chief Guy.
Yeah.
Right? And if any of them die, because they've been killing off Tuskens all along. But if those three die, then I will be very irate.
Yeah. Was the third one the child, you said?
The child, yeah. The child was the first one.
Completely agree. Yeah. Like stories are manipulations, like they're designed to manipulate us, but I would feel very unfairly and I would feel, I'd be kind of furious if those three.
Surprise me, Jon Favreau. Surprise me, because I know your tricks and I'm going to call you out on them now. Mm-hmm. Surprise me. Pleasantly surprise me that all three of them, his hot Tuscan girlfriend, the chief guy, and the kid, all are alive and well and helping him in the end. That would be amazing. That's actually the hero's journey when you collect allies along the way and they show up at the end to help you out, or they give you help when you keyly need it in the final battle.
Yeah. You return from the trials with like a boon for the community, right?
Yes.
Like some kind of... And if there's no community left because they got all killed off for like some shock value, like some red wedding moment. Yeah, like, that would be.
Well, it's more about like you need to understand that there's sacrifices that are made along the way. Maybe the mm-hmm. chief's going to die. Maybe. Yeah. But if he kills off all of them.
Yeah.
Friends off Jon Favreau.
Yeah.
You are the writer of the show, and you know how important these people. You've made us love them. You've made us love them. We love them. Congratulations. We love them as much as Baby Yoda, right?
Yeah.
We love them. Don't take them mm-hmm. away.
Yeah, I mean, this is the guy who directed Elf, okay? And like James Caan and is it Zooey Deschanel? Like, they're still alive and well at the end of Elf, so... Yes, I would like that to be the case. Yeah, but Elf wasn't
something that he played with blasters when he was a kid. He didn't play with those figures, right?
Yeah.
So this is a different thing, and he views this as a fundamental, he views the sacrificial mentor trope especially as a really, really important thing. And like, go back to those gallery episodes, and I have a very based fear for my Tusken babies.
Yeah. We, you sort of introduced me to the pretty obvious in retrospect, but it didn't occur to me that like we first meet Boba in The Mandalorian, you know, end of, you know, middle of season one or something, like after chapter five, you know, we sort of hear his spurs and we don't know what the hell he was up to for a lot of that time. So yeah, the timelines could bleed together.
It's 5 years, right?
It's yeah.
That's what we think time-wise has passed, because it's Return of the Jedi to around 5 years after Return of the Jedi. Mm-hmm. And yeah, why did he leave the tribe? Maybe Fennec's with him in the tribe and he voluntarily leaves to go and be like, I must find my armor, or I found out that my armor was stolen from this dude who looks like a Mandalorian. Like, maybe that's what happens, but to me, the impetus to leave a comfortable, accepted situation feels more like an extinction event.
Yeah. It feels like he doesn't really care about his father's armor right now.
Yeah.
And it's real important to him in Mando.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So why I'm is worried. It so important to him?
Yeah.
And I hate to be like the, you know, I have no fear, and then I have one fear meme. But this is my, like, legitimately, I have loved these two episodes.
Yeah.
Like you said, like, this might be one of your favorite pieces of Star Wars up there, right? And I agree. Yeah. This episode was so solid. I was actually talking with my husband about it. He's like, what is this show? I'm like, yeah. Like, this is the best Star Wars that has come out since The Rise of Skywalker.
Yeah.
The best. And like, my fear is that there's still the tricks up the bag. You know, we've made you care about these characters, so we're going to take them away, right? And that worries me. So if you're still here and now you're scared too, I'm sorry. I just needed to vent about this. It's really bothering me.
In episode one, when we were introduced to Tusken warrior Joanna Bennett's, you know, badass Tusken character,
She needs a name and she needs her own voice.
They need, yes, you know? They need, definitely need names, or something like a name. Yeah, however,
like, he needs to have asked for their names, like,
yeah,
at some point. If they don't, it's like falling into the Mandalorian. You remember Mandalorian season one? You and I were covering it. I'm like, no one has a name. Apparently, you need to read the subtitles to find out the character's name, or check IMDb afterwards. John, bad writing. Bad, bad, bad writing.
It's, yeah.
And then suddenly Dave Filoni writes an episode and it's like, yes, so-and-so name. Yes, so-and-so name. So-and-so name said what?
Yeah. His name is Grogu, huh? Anyway,
anyway. Like, literally, Dave Filoni's like, no, insert name here all the time. Insert name here. Control V, name.
The first thing I noticed was that the club, the Gatterfee stick, the Gaffy stick that she wields in the first episode of Boba is pretty much like the one that he made. And so I was sort of worried in episode one, and then I saw episode two and I was like, oh my God, like, they're handling this with such sensitivity. Like, I love all of this. This is perfect. And now, yeah, I'm kind of like synthesizing, okay, like, where is this headed? Oh shit. You know? yeah.
Is this a train heading towards a cliff?
Yeah. I'm hope
scared.
Not.
And again, this show has this show was sold as a big Boba Fett sitting on a throne with his hot Fennec girlfriend, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not that show. It's not. No. That's not what's happening right now. Maybe eventually. Maybe. It's also not the gritty underworld of Tatooine. Not that show either, right? Yeah. We're not getting the show that was sold to a very specific subset of the audience who are probably very pissed off. Like, I got to tell you, like, one of the biggest things about selling stuff is like genuinely selling what you're going to get. I know yeah. You got to obfuscate a little bit, but it feels like Lucasfilm is like in this weird, like we have these, it's like a veil dance of obfuscation because they can't piss off the legacy Boba Fett fans, but they're going to be pissed off as soon as they watch the show. They're going to be more pissed off because they had no idea what to expect. And you're like pulling the blanket from them. And like, now you're in the cold. They're like, ah, I'm cold. Like, I mean, was it just to prevent the pre-bitching? Like, I don't know. I mean, we knew what was going to happen. I've been talking about this since Mandalorian season one. If they bring back Boba Fett, what would happen? I'm like, well, he's going to have a rebirth in the Sarlacc pit, and then they're going to go from there. And it's going to be a complete transformation of character, because that's what you do when you rebirth. I've been literally saying this for years. It's not, none of this is a surprise really to me. It's just a surprise how good it is, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Just how good season two was and how weird it got. And yeah, it was.
It's not to pat myself on the back, but like symbolism doesn't lie unless it's like dissident, right? Then like don't talk to me about Tross. Like, it makes me want to vomit from symbolism dissidents. Like,
yeah.
But this is all on brand. This is saying the same thing. We haven't gotten to the part where I know it's going to say Tusken's going to die. But I mean, from a storytelling perspective, it's a thing he has done even in The Mandalorian, right? Mm-hmm. So I fear. On a side note, if this is Lawrence of Arabia, I'll give you some hope. If this is Lawrence of Arabia, the Arabians are fine.
Yeah.
He leaves. They're fine.
I did have the thought that maybe they vanish for whatever reason. They go into hiding. They talked about hiding. And so maybe for 4 or 5 years, Boba thinks that his tribe is dead. And actually they've gone off because they had to dip for whatever reason. Because they're kind of a
Or maybe they're joined together finally because he's joined all the tribes together and they're finally, you know, doing their thing. But he's not invited because they have to do their own thing.
Yeah, I mean, Din wanted to settle down with, is it Omara?
Omara, yeah.
Yeah, like, it, you know, but he had to kind of like leave her and finish his various quests, his Grogu-related duties. And you know.
Changing diapers, finding a force master.
You know, I like to imagine that eventually, like, that wrong will be righted, and you know, like, we'll get back to that place of like, okay, we're going back to, you know, where we want to be. And so I'm glad to hear that Lawrence of Arabia has a happy
Lawrence came home to Britain and became a very boring and weird person. Like, if you've seen Lawrence of Arabia, it all starts because he was in a motorcycle accident and people are at his funeral and they're like, this guy was a very boring dude, and they're like, no, he was not. Look at all the stuff he did. So I mean, if it's following Lawrence of Arabia, they're probably fine, right? I just, one fear.
I will say, textually, surface level stuff, my gripe with the show so far is that Fennec is just kind of hanging out. And like, when she does get to like do her stabby girlfriend routine, like, I love it. I love what she's, how she is and the things she says, and she seems to, you know, have this great sort of, you know, worldview that's very separate from Boba's whole deal. Yeah. But like, she doesn't get to do a lot.
I mean, like, to me, the we'll have to see, of course, right? Because I think it's that this 2-episode arc was actually the first opening episode back to back.
Yeah.
And I think that we'll get less and less vision quest as he's spending less and less time in the Bacta psychologist pod while he's working through his ego death. We'll get less and less of that, and then we'll get more Fennec time.
Yeah, very true. A lot of like prestige TV dramas will drop the first two episodes as like a single thing, like you were saying. So yeah, I like the notion that it's almost one episode.
I think it works better as one episode, actually, just because it has that kick at the end. Like he's in his new outfit and he has completed his first quest and he's got, whereas the first episode, like he fought the mini like sand creature, right? The mini boss, but he didn't actually take down the train in the desert. And so to me, it's just about structure. And like, they probably felt like they couldn't get him to point A to point B in one episode, but it felt weird to release like a 2 hour first episode or an hour and a half first episode, but they probably should have just done an hour and a half first episode. It probably would have been better.
Yeah. I did notice like logistically or whatever, him going to the sanctuary bar the second time felt a little pointless. It doesn't really achieve a lot. And so if you wanted to start like another like editing room conspiracy, you know, it could have been that the Hutts showed up at the end of the first episode originally. And then they're like, no, that's too much. You know, that's giving away too much. And, there's so little quote unquote present day in episode two. You just really get the Hutts showing up. That's about it. And
you get the cool, like the mayor is smart.
Well, moment. Yeah, I did love that scene.
And you get cool Rancor, like the Rancor's not there, man.
Sure, sure. Yeah, yeah.
Poor Rancor.
No, that was fun. It's fun, but I don't know. It felt like you had sort of two big kind of reveal moments in episode two, and then episode one, it was mostly just like the standard obvious stuff, even though I enjoyed the hell out of it. But
this episode was longer. And if you brought back the Hutt reveal to the Hutt reveal and put it under the first episode, they'd probably be more equal in length.
Yeah.
So I like your conspiracy theory, Alex Kane. I don't know.
I don't know.
No, I believe everything you say. You are an insider, aren't you?
No.
Just kidding.
No, but you know what I mean, though? Like, the mayor says, like, go speak to Garza Fwip and she will reveal all. And she's just like, oh, yeah, the Hutts are coming down the street. And then he's like out in the street. Like, there was no real reason to have a scene at the sanctuary in episode two, much as I like that place and I like these characters and et cetera. But like, nothing is really achieved in that beat, that scene, other than go outside, the Hutts are coming. I loved the episode. I'm not complaining, but it's just kind of interesting. There might have been some trickery there.
Yep.
Or not.
Or not. And with that, the most unfair aspect and the thing that I hate the most is that I have to wait another week for a new episode of Book of Boba Fett. It has become a highlight of my week. Can you believe that? It's Paul Rudd eating the hot wings. You and I, we're here. Yeah. Who would have thunk, right?
Yep.
We're here and we're enjoying this show and I'm here for the ride. I have my fears, but I'm here to listen. I will definitely watch and absorb what the storytellers, they've gained that much trust from me, like to absorb what they're saying and to really just follow along with the story.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel I haven't been as invested in Star Wars as I am now after episode two, since like what, the final Rise of Skywalker trailer with like the magical Yoda music. Like this, you know, it's been a long time. It's been a rough couple years and it feels good again. Star Wars doesn't hurt anymore. You know,
the teddy bear is like taking out a few of its knives for me. I'm loving it. It's great.
Yeah.
All right, Alex, we have talked for a very long time. I blame the five bullet point pages of notes.
Sorry.
No, it's me too. I like symbols and I like symbolism and I like mythical psychological conversation. And this show is doing a lot and it's amazing. But where can people find you if they're looking for you in between this show and the next?
I'm writing a little here and there, usatoday.com, reviewed.com, polygon.com, and on Twitter at Alex J. Kane.
Thank you, everyone, for checking us out. And we'll be back for the next episode. Book of Boba Fett, Chapter 3. Come back. And we'll see you then. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to What the Force. I'm Marie-Claire Gould, your host. Our music is orchestral music by Christy Carew for What the Force. We have a Patreon at patreon.com/whattheforce. We like to thank all our patrons, especially those who love and are obsessed with What the Force: Brad, Melody, Night Huntress in Wild Space, Felicia, How Rude, Anna Perez, Macau Mom, Neil, James, Joellen D, Christian Luca, Josh Johnson, Scott C, and Susan. Make sure to like and subscribe on YouTube or leave a 5-star review on iTunes or other pod apps. It helps people find the show. Check out our other channel on YouTube or other podcast feeds, What the Fiction. You can connect with us on Twitter at WTForceShow, What the Force Podcast on Facebook, or our website, whattheforce.ca, or on our Discord. Links are in the liner notes. Feel free to reach out and start a conversation. Cheers.